Do you need a guidebook for life? I'm Keith MacArthur, and this is my instruction manual. In this episode, we're texting, we're tweeting, we're sending emails. We're certainly talking at each other a lot, but conversations aren't just about talking. They're also about listening. I speak with Celeste Headlee, who delivered the enormously popular TED Talk, 10 Ways to Have Better Conversations. She's author of the new book, We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter.
We have sort of a genetic biological problem, and that is that human beings just don't listen well. We're not born good listeners. And so that's difficult in and of itself because the vast majority of people at some point are offered a public speaking course, but almost nobody's offered a course in how to listen.
And I speak with our fitness contributor, Kathleen Trotter, who critiques my fitness regime. I worked as a journalist for a decade, so I should know a thing or two about how to conduct an interview. But the truth is, because I was a newspaper reporter, all of my questioning took place away from public scrutiny. If I did a bad interview, maybe because I wasn't listening carefully, nobody ever knew. Until now. Podcasts are different. If I'm not prepared or don't ask the right follow-up question, you can hear it. So I'm still learning how to do this better. This means talking to today's featured guest is both a huge honor and a little intimidating. Celeste Headlee has worked in radio for 2 decades. Her latest book is We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter. The book is an expansion on a TED Talk that has been viewed millions of times, which provides important steps about how to have better conversations. Celeste is the host of the daily news show on Second Thought on Georgia Public Broadcasting. Celeste, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Now, Celeste, I know from reading your book that if I ask you your advice, you're more likely to like me. So I'm going to start by asking you some advice. I typically start these podcast interviews with questions that guests are expecting me to ask, and they kind of give their rehearsed answers. And then as I listen back later to the recording, to the interview, I notice that as the interview moves on, it tends to move in unexpected directions and the conversation kind of gets more interesting. So my question for you is it better for me to start asking you something that you know I'm going to ask first and you're prepared and you're expecting me to answer and where I probably know how you're going to answer? Or is it better for me to ask something unexpected that I'm genuinely curious about?
Yeah, I think the latter is better. And the reason why is because when you ask the expected question, right, their brain never really has to engage to answer that. They can absolutely be, well, in this case, literally phoning it in, but figuratively phoning it in as well. What I find is the best first question is one that sort of demonstrates that you actually did your homework, right, that you spent the time and had the kind of respect for your guest that you read the book or you looked into their work or you are asking for a clarification on something they said earlier, meaning that you actually looked up what they said earlier. Those kind of questions are great openers because, A, you're asking them a question about their own work so they'll know the answer. You're inviting them to talk about themselves, which always feels really, really good. But you're also perking them up. You're waking their brain cells up in a way that the expected question doesn't.
Okay, so let me try. So this is something that I was thinking as I was reading the book, which is that this book is different from other books that I've read about conversations. And the reason is that so many of the other books, I feel, tend to be focused more to people who are kind of scared of conversations or maybe because they're introverted or they're socially awkward. But it feels like yours is either broader or maybe even the advice that you give maybe even applies more to people who are sometimes extroverts and may not even know they need these tips. They might think they're great conversationalists. Do you agree?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, research shows that that's most of us. Most people overestimate their own conversational skills and their own listening skills. And it's turned out to be true as I give speeches all around the country. The number one most common question is about how to change other people's behavior. It's how to stop someone else from interrupting you. It's how to stop somebody else from running on and on and on. Almost everyone wants me to tell them how to change someone else's behavior. I almost never hear from people on how do I stop myself from interrupting people.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the question I really rarely get. And that's sort of who this book is aimed at. It's aimed at all of us because we all have conversations and we all tend to think we're pretty good at it. But that's because for people like you and me, we're good talkers, right? We're engaging speakers and we're smart and we're articulate and we say funny stuff and witty stuff. And we think that translates into good conversation, and it just doesn't.
Do you think there's still some people that read the book or watch your TED talk who think that doesn't apply to me? I know how to do this.
Oh, I'm sure you know that there are. You know there's people that immediately are going to only be thinking about other
people. I can think of a few.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I don't recommend ever reading any comments ever, but I have read some of the comments like on the TED page, and they immediately start saying, I need to send this to my family because they're all terrible. Right? I mean, that's really common.
Yeah. So what's wrong with the current state of conversation?
So there's a couple things.
By the way, this if you said I should start with the question where I knew what you were going to say and you'd already thought about what you were going to say, this is how I was going to start.
This is it, right?
This is it, yeah.
Right. But, you know, we have sort of a genetic biological problem, and that is that human beings just don't listen well. We're not born good listeners. And we have to learn how to listen. And so that's difficult in and of itself because the vast majority of people at some point are offered a public speaking course, but almost nobody's offered a course in how to listen. So that's one challenge that we have. So then you add on top of that our current problems, which are just the incredible distraction that our cell phones create. And then there's this weird, I honestly can't explain the drive that we have to find an unending stream of replacements for human conversation. Of all the things that we could focus on with our technology, why do we want to keep trying to replace face-to-face and voice conversation? I really don't know, because that's the one thing we do better than any other species. And so we keep trying to get rid of it. And so you layer on this, to my mind, unnecessary in most cases, technology and distraction and the shortened attention spans that so many people have recorded onto our already difficult challenge in listening to each other anyway, and you just have a recipe for disaster.
So are you the type of person that if I sent you an email, you'll give me a call?
Often.
Or come to my office?
Exactly. When I tell my staff that all the time, sometimes they'll be sitting 15 feet away from me and send an email, and I'll lean out my door and say, I deleted that. Come talk to me. But usually with emails, there are a few things that email's good at. And a simple exchange of information, like sending an agenda or sending instructions, totally great. But if we have a back and forth that's at least three back and forths, or there's any kind of argument or nuance or explanation or vagueness in there, I will say, hey, we're not going to settle this over email. When can I have 5 minutes of your time on the phone?
You admit in the book that you haven't always been a perfect conversationalist. What's an example of one really bad conversation that you've had? What's the worst?
Oh my God, that's just too hard to choose from. I mean, I'm sure if you ask anybody who knew me in college, I was an insufferable know-it-all. And I was always, one of the things I say not to say in the book is, actually, right, don't start a question with, but actually, and I used to do that all the time. People would,
say something. People.
Right. I was correcting people all the time. And I'm sure it was just infuriating. In fact, many of my friends told me that I was infuriating. I can't imagine I was pleasant to talk to. And I always say, you know, one of the reasons I know this subject so well is because I was so bad at so much of it. That I kind of had to learn the hard way by mucking it up so often. I had plenty of fights with people that didn't need to be fights. I had a friendship basically end because I was so angry with her over something that she'd done, I couldn't get past it. Right? So I wasn't really listening to her. All I wanted to do was have her admit that I was right and she was wrong. And so, you know, friendship ended that way, and that's the worst outcome, right?
Yeah.
There's lots of examples.
So if people master the skills that you recommend in the book, does that help them to overcome other people's weaknesses in conversations?
It actually does. Human beings are actually designed to learn by modeling. We learn through modeling behavior, right? I mean, if you go into, it's no small thing to talk about the culture of an office, right? You get a new job, you go into that office, and there's certain things that people do or don't do, or certain things they say, the way that they dress. That's all part of the culture. And we model our own behavior on what we see around us. Nobody hands you a book saying, this is how we dress. These are the kind of slang we used. This is, you know, whether or not you're allowed to cook popcorn in the microwave. These are things that we watch and we observe and we learn from that. We learn how to behave. And so if this is someone that you're speaking to on a relatively regular basis, I have seen it work over and over again in my own personal life and in my business work, that when I changed my own behavior and I was consistent about it, eventually other people will change. I mean, unless they're a sociopath, right? But
right.
they're going to change for nobody, for absolutely no reason whatsoever. But in all other cases, you will see a change in behavior.
You have 10 tips. We probably don't have time to get into all of them today, but what are one or two that are kind of the most important or the easiest to master that'll make the biggest difference?
So those are two different things, right? whether they're most important or easiest to master.
Right. Because listening might be the most important and one of the hardest to master, I would guess.
That is exactly what I was going to say. Okay. But I think one of the easiest...
See, there, now I'm being a know-it-all.
But you're right. So I think probably the easiest thing to accomplish, and you can do it right now today, is the first one about being present. Maybe not in the broader sense of it, like learning mindfulness, that's kind of hard. But in terms of like setting yourself up for success, you can do that immediately. And the way that you do that is mostly by managing your cell phone at this point. There's good research in there that shows that just the presence of your cell phone, having it anywhere within your line of sight, is deeply distracting to your own brain, and it has a real effect on the brain of the person who's talking to you. They're less likely to view you as friendly, trustworthy, empathetic when they see that phone on the table, even if it's not making noise. So that's the first thing you can do, is not put your phone down, but put it away. And the other thing you can do is turn off your notifications. Because it's really likely you have more notifications than you need. I've turned off every notification on my phone that's not either my calendar or coming from an actual living, breathing human, like a text message. Yeah. All the rest of them, like, I don't need to know when somebody likes my Facebook posts. I don't need to know when they retweet me. I don't need any of that stuff. If it's being automatically generated, I turned it off. So that's the easiest one. And as you alluded to, listening is the hardest. But I actually want to talk in terms of significant. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about one of the other ones. And the reason I want to go further into it is because this is the one I get the most pushback on. And that's the one about not talking about similar experiences that you've had.
Yes.
So
I watched the TED Talk first, and I thought, I don't know if I agree with that one. And then I read the book and you say, this is the one a lot of people say they don't agree with.
It's true. I mean, a lot of people feel, and I truly believe they feel like they're expressing empathy. And that may be the original motivation. I believe that. And I believe it because I think that's why I did it all the time.
Right.
But what we know is that that's not the end result. Now, it's really understandable that when someone says, hey, I lost my job, the way that our brains work is we take in new information, and the way that we put it in context is your brain is going to be like your reference librarian, right? They're going to search through the files to find similar experiences or relevant experiences that might help you put that new information into context. That's totally natural and normal and good. But at the moment when you open up your mouth and start expressing those, that's when it becomes not good anymore. That information is for you. It's to help you. It's not necessarily to help the other person. And as soon as you start to express, tell those stories and talk about the similar experiences, you're pulling the focus away from that person who needs the focus and onto yourself.
Right. Yeah. And the reason I was struggling with it is because when I was a people manager in my last job, that's something that I got given advice of what I should be doing to be a better manager, is to tell stories of my own experience when people tell me about things they're going through.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad advice out there.
Yeah.
there really is. And I think, you know, this whole journey for me began because I was looking for a way to become a better interviewer. That's how it all started.
Right.
I wanted to do better interviews. And so I, you know, in typical NPR employee fashion, I read everything I could get my hands on. That's what we do. And yeah. I started reading all these books on conversation, and they were just the – but see, here's the thing, and you probably experienced this also, but I get to test that stuff out. I talk to dozens of people in conversation every single week. So I can take that little piece of advice, maintain eye contact, and I can try it out for weeks in the studio and see if it makes a positive difference or a negative difference. And what I discovered is that the vast majority of the advice out there didn't actually help. It often made things worse. So that's kind of where this all began, as I was like, you know, I really need to start from scratch.
I bet you get pushback that people will say that an interview is much different from a conversation, right? An interview, I've got a specific job where I'm trying to get information out of you. I'm not necessarily giving in the same way. Some people might say, how does that apply to the conversations that I have with my spouse?
And I would have agreed with them a few years ago. I thought they were two different things. Mm-hmm. But it was when I started applying naturally, because I was practicing these new skills all the time. And so I would come home and very naturally use those same things when I was talking to my spouse. And I realized it worked just as well. There are some things about interviews that are different. In a conversation, the power and the platform is shared. In an interview, clearly not. One person is in charge of that interview. Another is that there's a time limit on it. And hopefully on most conversations, there isn't. But frankly, sometimes there is,
right.
You know, a lot of times you're in the middle, you're on your way to go do something or whatever it may be. There are time limits on conversations also. So it just turned out that there were the advice that I was learning that was working for me in the studio was over 90% of the time also working when I tried it out with my kid and my friends and everybody else in my regular life.
Of the tips, which one is the hardest for you personally?
The wandering mind.
Right.
That I have adult ADD.
Okay.
So yeah,
You really do?
I really do.
Okay. Some people use it as you know when
No, you do.
Yeah.
I actually mean that I have adult ADD, and that's one of the lovely gifts I've passed on to my son.
Right.
So it is very difficult for me. I am, you know, they always try to get you when you're doing some business training, they'll try to train you in radiant thinking. And I'm like, radiant thinking is my subtitle. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
All I do is radiant thinking. So that one's really difficult for me. And it makes it hard to listen, right? Cause I get all caught up in what's going on in my head. And suddenly realize I have no idea what the person just said for the past
right.
few minutes. I'm off on this tangent. So that one's really tough for me. And that was one of the first things I had to sort of grapple with, because just like you were describing in your intro of moving from a reporter where it doesn't matter, you're not talking on live radio or you're not creating
yeah.
a conversation, right? And then moving to become not just a talk show host, but live on the air.
Right.
Very that's different. It's really different. And I had to start fixing my distraction problem. So that was one of the very first I had to figure out how to fix.
You say in the book that sometimes you'll even stop people and say, I can't focus on this right now. Can we talk about it later? And actually,
yeah.
you know, I can really relate to that. Last night I was out for dinner with my wife and there was something she was asking me, but I was trying to look at the menu and figure out what I was going to order because we were in a bit of a rush. And so I tried that technique and it worked.
Yeah. And, you know, it's surprising to me how often we try to come up with other solutions to just telling people the truth.
Right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I was on the Today Show and one of the questions they asked me is, you know, what do you do if someone says that you're pooling money together for a gift and the limit is $100 and you can't afford it? And I was like, well, you tell them you can't afford that. You know, there's no magic words there. You're just honest without being a jerk about it. You just tell them, hey, that's too rich for my blood. And it's the same thing with distractedness, where I just say, look, I want to listen to you, but right now I can't. My brain is completely in a million different places. So put a pin in it. Let's come back.
You talk about the importance of the words, I don't know.
Yeah. Because we have a tough time saying that. Our idea of how often we say I don't know is very different than reality. We actually don't say it as much as we may think. And it's unfortunate. And because we don't know most things. I mean, think about this for just a second. Of all the information in the world, every one of us knows a tiny little sliver of that information pool. Yeah. So most things you won't know, but it's a real problem. And I think that Google, frankly, has made this worse because we all think we're just a couple clicks away from being an expert on something because we somehow have gotten this idea that reading a couple paragraphs of some article makes you an expert. So, you know, they've done these studies. There's this great book called The Illusion of Knowledge, and it's very recent. And they did this study in which, for example, they asked a whole bunch of people, what do you think we should do about the situation in Ukraine? Hmm. And then they asked them, point to Ukraine on a map.
Right.
And the worse your geography was, and it was all bad. The average was off by 1,800 miles. Okay, so it was all very bad. But the worse your geography was, the more likely you were to recommend military intervention.
Wow, that's interesting.
Right? I mean,
that's related. Yeah. I mean, that's related to the results of other studies you talk about in the book, where I think.
Yeah, the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Right.
That which shows that when you are incompetent in a subject, you are also not capable of knowing that you're incompetent.
Right.
The very competence that makes you a master of the subject is what is required to know who is a master and who isn't. So if you know nothing about tennis, you don't actually understand how good Serena is. Right? Yeah. So, yeah, and this is the problem with us not saying, I don't know, or, you know, chiming in all the time on Facebook with our pretty unfounded opinions. Everyone has a right to their opinion, but many of them are just founded on nothing but gut instinct. And I'll tell you right now, your gut, it will steer you, it will do you wrong. It will do you wrong. Your gut is not really to be trusted. You know, it's just not a good idea to rely on the gut. So getting into the habit of saying, I don't know, which again is a habit. Like that was, you know, I was explaining earlier what a big know-it-all I was. That was really hard for me to start learning how to say, I don't know, to make that split second decision when someone's talking about something, not to offer up my opinion or sort of tell them what I do know on that subject, but to simply say, you know, I don't really know enough to comment.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah. No, that could be really hard. This has been great. You've already shared so much wisdom about how we can have better conversations, but I'm hoping to converse a little more with you. I want to ask you 5 questions to try to uncover and learn from your personal instruction manual, the Celeste Headlee Recipe for Success. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so first, what are the good habits you try to follow every day to make sure Celeste stays happy and healthy?
Well, I have a basic routine that I stick to most of the time. I exercise in the mornings because I know that's the only time I'm going to stick to it. I meditate every day for at least a minimum of 20 minutes. I make my bed every morning, and I make sure I get in 4-6 servings of fruits and vegetables plus at least 80 ounces of water.
Yeah, it's amazing how many of the people that I talk to have meditation on their list. And it's interesting that it was in your book as well as something that'll help us be better conversationalists.
Yeah, it helps with a lot of stuff. But conversation is one of the many.
If you could recommend one personal development book, what would it be?
Wow, that's a really good question. One personal development book. Frankly, one of the ones that made the biggest difference to me, and it wasn't actually specifically a personal development book, but it's Amy Poehler's memoir.
Oh, really?
And I know that sounds weird, but I've read it like 2.5 times now. I keep going back to it because she's basically talking to you about how she created the life that she has now. And a lot of it is about empowerment. It's about trusting yourself. It's about learning to quiet the doubts. It's also about sort of like getting along with other really strong, smart, creative minds as well. And I just found it really instructive. I know she didn't mean it like that, but I found it really not only inspiring, which it definitely was, but also instructive. My copy is just ragged and filled with highlights.
Have you interviewed her?
I have not. I've never had the chance. But my book was featured on her Amy Poehler Smart Girls thing.
Oh, okay. Do you have a personal mantra or favorite inspirational quote to share?
The one that I almost always listen or repeat back to myself is the Dalai Lama, which is, be kind whenever possible. It is always possible. And I, yeah. If you want to talk about a mantra, that's it.
Celeste, what's your one guilty pleasure?
Nachos.
Nachos. I love nachos too.
While I'm wearing footy pajamas on the couch watching a movie. Yeah, that's
okay.
It.
Okay. And then the last question for Celeste's instruction manual. None of us live forever. When your time comes, how do you want to be remembered?
I hope I'm just remembered for having done the best I could to leave the world better than I found it. I just want to have, in the end, when the final calculation is made, I want to have been a positive influence on the world and to have my life to have been of use to people.
Well, definitely being on the podcast, I know that your time will be of use to the listener. So thank you so much. Where can people follow and connect with you?
The easiest thing, they can find me on Twitter or on Facebook. It's real easy. It's just my name. Or if they are thinking of buying the book, they can go to my website, CelesteHeadley.com, and I have a list of like all the different places where you can buy it. Makes it really easy for you.
Okay. Thanks so much, Celeste.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come, our compassionate trainer, Kathleen Trotter, examines my personal fitness routine and tells me why running and upper body weights isn't enough. I want to have a conversation that matters with you. Have feedback on the podcast, ideas of guests I should interview? You can reach me at keith@myinstructionmanual.com. This is the part of the podcast where I welcome one of our regular contributors. Kathleen Trotter is a personal trainer and author of Finding Your Fit, a compassionate trainer's guide to making fitness a lifelong habit. Kathleen, how are you?
I'm great. I'm excited for this. I feel like this is a segment I've never done. I've done lots of podcasts and never have I been asked to critique the host's fitness regime. So it's exciting.
Yeah. See, I'm a little nervous about this one.
Oh, you never have to be nervous. That's one of the pleasures of training with me is, you know, I have compassion both for myself and for the people that I train. It's all about a growth mindset, as we've talked about for the last couple weeks, right? Whatever you're doing is great, and then we'll just tweak it. Or maybe you won't need any tweaking. Maybe you'll be perfect.
Let's hope. Well, so I'm going to start telling you a little bit about my fitness habits, and you can ask me questions. We'll take it from here.
Perfect.
So growing up, like you, when I was a teenager, I was super unfit. In university, I started running and kind of did it off and on for a while. A few years ago, I started getting more seriously into it. I did a bunch of half marathons. I did one 30K, but ended up struggling for the last 5 to 10 kilometers. So I decided not to try to do a marathon. So I just stuck to half marathons. But then, as listeners know, I got sick with kidney disease and really couldn't do much exercise at all. It got to the point where even standing was just exhausting until I got my new kidney for my sister. So now I'm at the point where I'm starting to get fit again. And in terms of my fitness routine, I probably go to the gym, and it's where you got started. It's the YMCA. I go there probably 3 to 4 times a week and kind of alternate between either going there or running outside for 20 minutes or more. And I try and build sprints into my runs. On the days when I'm not doing that, I do weights, focusing on my upper body.
Okay. Well, first of all, congratulations on making exercising a habit. I think that that's fantastic. And I always like to start with acknowledging people's positives. And the first is that you're really regular. You've made it a routine, which is great. I love that you're including intervals in your runs. That's fantastic.
And for people who don't know, why is that important?
To increase your fitness, basically. So if you think about interval training as it's alternating between bouts of higher and lower intensity activity. So if you think about it as highway versus city driving. So when you're in the city and then you get on the highway, you're like, oh, I'm going really fast. And then you get back off of the highway and you're like, oh, this is kind of slow. So that's sort of like what it is. Your regular routine of running is city driving. And if you only ever city drive, when you go fast, when you try to run fast, it will feel fast. But once you start highway driving or doing more interval training, then your regular speed becomes easier, and then your new normal becomes faster and stronger. So it's the way to be a faster runner or faster and more fit at anything. It's also right. Great for your metabolism, fat burning, all that kind of fun stuff. The main thing I would say, is that as I tell my clients, you have to get in shape to run, not run to get in shape. Meaning, running is really hard on the body. It's hard for your body to dissipate forces, and I'm not knocking running because I am a runner and I absolutely adore running and it's my bliss. But what I'm saying is, in order to be able to run injury free, and run for the rest of your life and do all those things, you have to train your lower body and you have to train your core, and you have to make sure you're stretching. So you have to build, it's great that you're doing your upper body, and that's a really common misconception for people who are runners. They're like, oh, I'm already doing enough for my legs. I don't need to train my legs. Mm-hmm. Right. And especially for guys, a lot of guys want to build their chest and their back and all of that stuff is great. But you have to do lower body stuff and especially functional single leg work, because running is basically a single leg exercise. So a lot of people, when they go to the gym and they do quote legs, they still do mainly bilateral legs. So they'll do squats, they'll do leg press, they're both great, but they're not functional for running. So practicing balancing on one leg, practicing, I love what I call clock lunges. So you're standing on your right leg, balancing on your right foot, and then you step your left foot forward to 12 o'clock, and then you step your left knee back up and balance on your right leg again. And then you step your leg out to 3 o'clock, and you do a lunge to 3 o'clock, and then you're coming back and balancing. So you're working on balance, you're working on coordination, you're working on that glute of the stabilizing leg. So I would say create a routine that works on single leg balance, core, and especially glute work, because when you run, you need what's called hip extension, which your butt, basically it's your butt pulling your leg back in space. And if you don't have your butt doing the work, you use your lower back, you use your hamstrings, or you overuse those muscles, so then you spasm your lower back, you spasm at your hamstring, and then you're injured and you can't run. And if running is your bliss, it's also helpful for your mental health, and then you feel more depressed and sad, and it kind of spirals from there. So.
Right. Yeah. I actually, when I was running all the half marathons, I got some really bad plantar fasciitis and had to stop running for about 6 months.
Yeah. And so the more muscle strength you have, the better you're going to be able to at dissipating those forces. And that's one of the problems with plantar fasciitis, is that the fascia, your body's not able to dissipate the forces of running. It's something like up to 6 times of your body weight on each of your legs when you land. Right. So that's really key for that.
Okay, so I've got to start doing more work on the lower body. Any other advice for me?
Yeah, not just lower body. It has to be single leg. It has to be balanced. It has to be core. So that would be the first thing. And the second thing would be just assess your goal. So where are you trying to go with these workouts? I mean, it's great that you're going 4 times a week, but are you trying to do a 5K? Do you want to go up to a 10K? Do you want to do a half marathon? Maybe you have a certain amount of push-ups you want to do, or a certain amount of pull-ups. The more goals that you can have that are not just go out and do it, the more reasons you have to stick to your routine. So your routine seems really regular, and the consistency is really key, but you'll have more motivation to keep going, and you'll have that sort of target to work towards if you could have goals. So I don't know if you can even think right now, like 2 things off the top of your head, and then we could target your program more appropriately to those goals.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, and I'm not far off from it now, but I think the biggest thing is just being able to run 5K again.
Well, that's a great goal. And so what we would do if we were going to work together is I would get you to say, okay, like, what are you doing with your runs now? Like, are you just going out and running for 20 minutes, or how does it work? Because maybe what you would need to do is, it's kind of 2 options. What you could do is break it down. So if right now you're just running for 20 minutes straight, what you could say is, okay, I want to get to 5K, which is roughly about 30 minutes. So what I'm going to do is, as opposed to trying to run for 20 minutes, I'm going to build in walk breaks. So I'm going to run I'm going to be out for a full 30 minutes, but I'm going to do 5 minutes running, 1 minute walking. So then you're training your body to be active for those full 30 minutes, even though you're not running the entire time. And then eventually, as opposed to 5-in-1s, you could do 6-in-1s, and then 7-in-1s, and then 10-in-1s, and then 15-in-1s, and then full 30 minutes. That's one option. The other option would be you could continue with your full 20 minutes that you're doing, and then after the run, jump on the elliptical and do 10 minutes on the elliptical or 5 minutes on the elliptical just to increase your stamina. Like mm-hmm. if your goal is the 5K.
So I have a sense of what I need to do now, but you had a good idea about how we could do something similar for our listeners.
Yeah, I thought it'd be really fun if a listener emailed in, or I don't know how they would get in touch with you, there, like a little blurb about their program, and then we could sort of dissect it a little bit as we chatted, and then whoever emailed in their information, I would then send them a book.
So here's how we do it. The best way is for listeners to record an audio comment and email it to keith@myinstructionmanual.com. So try to keep it short, like under a minute. And if you're unable to do an audio segment, you can send a written analysis or a written description of your fitness routine by email. And make sure to include your first name and where you're writing us from. So we'll pick one of the best ones and air it on a future podcast. And as Kathleen said, she is generously going to give away a copy of her book.
Yeah, I think it sounds really fun.
Kathleen, thanks for being compassionate in your critique of me today.
I think you're doing really well. I think you should be really proud of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You have grit, which is one of my goals in life, is to have grit. I think that you are the definition of grit.
Well, we've talked about grit before, so I know that's important to you. That's great to hear. Thank you. So where can people follow up and connect with you?
My website is KathleenTrotter.com. Kathleen Trotter Fitness is Instagram. K Trotter Fitness is Twitter. And I'm Kathleen Trotter on Facebook.
So that's episode 8. If you know someone who might relate to this episode, whether it's that person you know who thinks he's a great communicator but could really use Celeste's help, or someone who might want their own fitness routine critiqued by Kathleen, please let them know about the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe. When you do, the podcast gets recommended to more people inside iTunes and other podcast services. I want to thank this week's guest, Celeste Headley, and our regular contributors, Kathleen Trotter, Michelle J. Lynn, and Joelle Anderson. You can reach me at keith@myinstructionmanual.com. I would love to hear from you. You can also reach out on Twitter, where I'm at Keith MacArthur. I've also launched some My Instruction Manual Pinterest boards. You can find them at pinterest.com/myinstructionmanual. My Instruction Manual is a division of FanReads, Inc. Thanks for listening. Now go make today a great day.